Have you ever lost something and thought for sure you'd never find it again? That's what Michael Torkey thought about the first composition he wrote when he was literally 5 years old. However, it showed up recently. That's one of the things you'll find out about in this edition of New Classical Tracks from American Public Media as we learn more about his new recording, Sky, and how bluegrass inspired him. I'm Julie Amacher. Enjoy. I'm talking with composer Michael Torkey about a brand new recording that he's recently released. But before we dive into that recording, Michael, I want to ask you, how does a young boy born in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, and raised in Wauwatosa become an internationally recognized American composer?
I think the short answer is a lot of luck. I don't come from a musical family to start with, so the fact that I would even study an instrument is a piece of luck. The story goes that there was a halftime show on television, a football game, and at age 3 or 4, I was pounding on a drum, and my mother's friend said, "I think he has rhythm. You find a piano, and I'll find a teacher." So right there, that was a miracle. Then the teacher that I was sent to, when I would come in and change around the pieces, because I guess I didn't know any better, saw that as creative rather than recalcitrant. And so I began to compose at I just turned 5 when we started lessons. I started composing from then on. And so it became a lifelong passion, and had the privilege of going to some of the best schools, Eastman School of Music, for example, perfect for my personality and the kinds of teachers I worked with. Spent 1 year at Yale, and then when I arrived in New York, doors had opened magically. Again, right time, right place. So, living now in Las Vegas for half the time, where luck is a big part of everyone's life, I look back on what luck played in my life.
When you just said that you did your first compositions at the age of 5, I was thinking about some other composers who, you know, would jot down things at a very early age, and then they'd tuck those things in a drawer and return to them later and turn them into something amazing. I was curious if you've ever returned to one of those earlier works or incorporated it in some way into one of your existing works.
Well, that's an interesting question. I was supposed to do that with a commission. About 10 years ago, I was supposed to look back into my boyhood and find something that I had written. And I remember my father always said, "Michael, can you go to the piano and play your Sad Waltz?" That was the name of the short piece I wrote when I was 5 years old. And I looked all through boxes. I looked through all storage. And I could never find that. And I remember the first couple bars, and it was one of those things where you're heartbroken. And just in May of this year, 2019, I had a premiere of a choral and orchestra piece in Sheboygan, Wisconsin. They were celebrating their 100th anniversary, the oldest orchestra in the state of Wisconsin. And this woman showed up who took piano lessons from the same teacher I did, who I was telling you about. Audrey Wood was her name. And she says, "I have a packet for you." When Audrey died, she left me her Steinway piano. And in the piano bench, there was all this music of yours, Michael. I opened it up, and there was the Sad Waltz. So maybe sometime in the future now I can use that theme.
Oh, wow. That's an amazing story. Really, think about that, the things that happen to us in our lives. And
yeah, that's amazing.
Wow, the conclusions that are created. You grew up in a very tight-knit family in suburban Milwaukee. You had both of your grandparents around. You had extended family around.
Yes.
You grew up in the Midwest with, you know, where people refer to our Midwest values. How has that impacted you and the way that, you know, the choices you've made along the way?
Yeah, I think that it's brought a kind of, one, emotional stability, because I had such good examples. Other than my mother dying at a young age of cancer, it was a very good marriage, and with both sets of grandparents being very close and very loving. A lot of creative people sometimes can suffer through emotional instability, and people, in fact, think that that's part of the fabric, the necessity of being an artist, which I don't think so at all. I mean, the classic cases, look at Bach. I mean, what a stable life he led, and a stable way that he approached his work. And so you don't have to have some stormy kind of chaos to create something is one thing I took away from my upbringing. Another is, this is a little bit harder to talk about, my father always took me aside and said, well, Michael, you know, on the two coasts, the West Coast and the East Coast, the people there are very different. And, well, how so, Dad? Well, they're just a little bit, you have to watch out. They're a little bit crazy. So this mythology of how somehow we had these very simple values. But I remember we took a tour of schools for college. And when we got to Juilliard, my parents said, well, our son is not going to go there. It's too sophisticated. Which I thought was ridiculous. That was my dream, to go to Juilliard. Well, wouldn't you know, they sent me to Eastman in Rochester, New York. But it was the perfect school for me, where I wasn't distracted by all the stimulation of New York. And so I worked very hard for 4 years. Anyway, what I learned moving to New York City, which was my dream, was there was something called irony. People say things and they mean something else. I couldn't get it. And that irony is like a literary form of expression. And it's taken me decades to understand irony, which I think is, you know, one of the great human creations. But I think that the fact that I was not raised on irony, there's a kind of an unironic expression, I believe, maybe it's not for me to say, in my own music. And I think that kind of comes through.
How do you think it comes through?
In that, I mean, if you think of how certain artistic expression, especially in postmodernism, someone will express something, but they actually mean something else. So they will represent something like a figure in a painting, but say, oh, it's actually an abstraction. It isn't about representing that person. It's about the idea that we can't represent anything, and I'm playing with that tension, and on and on, and it gets very heady. And I appreciate all of those approaches to art. Very fascinating. But for me, music is so primitive and comes right from the soul, or from our spirit, or from our emotions, that in a certain way, the directness that I try to achieve, I feel something and it comes out in a very direct way. I think it lacks that kind of dressing up in irony.
I'm really intrigued by the fact that you did not grow up in a musical family, yet you were a classical music nerd, oblivious to pop music, really. How did that happen?
Oh, well, I mean, no one is oblivious to pop music because, of course, it's on the radio all the time. I used to say that in interviews. I think it was that most people my age were listening to rock and pop, and I wanted to go to Interlaken, and I wanted to go to Tanglewood, and I wanted to go to all the music festivals because all I wanted to hear was classical music. I thought that being a classical music nerd is probably the right expression. And I think that I gave up some of that pomposity when around the time I was in college, where I realized that all music has something to offer. In fact, pop music teaches us something important. And again, this relates to what I was saying just moments ago, that in contemporary classical concert music, a lot of difficult, inscrutable music was written. And I always wondered why, because it seemed to me that the music existed, I would say, at arm's length away. You had to exercise the frontal cortex of your brain to really get into it. That's exciting, but that's what you had to do. Then I remember in school I would put on a piece of Tchaikovsky and I would think, well, that's much closer. I immediately get something. It's just as engaging as the modernist music, but it's closer. And then I would listen to some Al Jarreau on the radio and it was in my face, so to speak. And so I thought, well, why couldn't concert classical music be in your face in terms of how it hits the ear? And it doesn't mean that it has to be dumbed down. That's the common argument everyone makes. But that somehow you're experiencing it front and center, and that it is going right into the back of your brain as opposed to having to be filtered by the front part of your brain.
I was just thinking that maybe that's why you claim Stravinsky and Bartok as two of your favorite composers, because they can get in your face.
Yeah, well, there's, again, that kind of directness. If we want to speak about Stravinsky in his rhythms, especially in the earlier music, and his approach to orchestration is very much close up and immediate. Maybe immediate is the better word.
Your career skyrocketed pretty quickly while you were still an undergrad at the Eastman School of Music. And I'm curious, what do you think was really most surprising for you about the way that your careers evolved?
I think that young people have ideas of what is going to happen in their life, and they're often wrong. I'll give you an example. My heroes in the early 80s, when I was still a student at Eastman, were two composers who were emerging in the international scene as being very different from any other composers. And now, of course, they're very famous, Steve Reich and Philip Glass. And what was so unusual was that they were not teaching at an academic post, and they were writing music that was used by people in New York. Dance companies were using it. Operas were made. People were playing it. And people outside of the small world of classical music, like artists, theatergoers, dancers, they were all enjoying it and listening to it and getting something out of it. And so I looked at them and I thought, well, that's the answer. That is one way out. And okay, what did those guys do then? You had Steve Reich and musicians, and you had the Philip Glass Ensemble. And so I thought, I'm going to go to New York and I'm going to start my own band, and I am going to work for 20 years until I'm age 40, and then I will be discovered by the establishment. So I get to New York in spring of 1985, and one of the first things is a tall man with dark sunglasses comes up and says, can you send us your music? Well, it was the guy, the top promotions person from Boosey and Hawkes, David Huntley, who was the head of the New York operations of the publisher at the time, who was the most important publisher in the world. And they were interested in representing me. And I almost said, well, no, I want to have a band and I want to be undiscovered for it. And then I thought, well, come on, this is a great opportunity. They can open up doors. And so, again, where did that come from? How did that happen? Years later, I heard that from London, their main office, they said, we've got too many old composers. We need to find a young composer. David Huntley, you go find someone. And so talk about luck. Right place at the right time.
You now have your own publishing company, and that came about out of necessity. However, now as a do-it-yourself composer, you may be also setting a precedent. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Well, there are two issues there. One is signing with a big publisher like Boosey and Hawkes. I didn't quite know what I was doing, and it took a couple years to figure out how the legal side of the entertainment business and the music business works. And what you want to do is you want to own all of your things. You want to own your copyrights. And it's kind of bizarre. It's the one art form where you grant the copyright to another entity. If you're an author of a novel, look in the front. It'll say copyright by Rick Moody. I'm just naming someone. I've just finished his memoir. Authors own their own copyrights. Well, often in music, these are granted to another entity. And it took me a while to figure out what that meant. And so in 1991, I decided to, on paper, start my own publishing company so I could retain those copyrights. But Boosey and Hawkes still represented me. They became my administrator. But they were my publisher. It took another 12 years where I completely broke away and hired other people to handle the services that one would look for. So in the sense that I'm do-it-yourself, that isn't completely true. I have two important people that I have hired to handle all of the publishing thing, whether it comes to sending out the parts to orchestras or helping me collect royalties abroad or dealing with television and movie people when they want to sync up your music to picture. I have experts doing that. What another lucky thing was that with the digital revolution, kind of the music business has now changed drastically. And all the services that a big publisher like Boosey & Hawkes used to do, they're unable to, from a variety of reasons, be the same kind of full-service publisher that they were back in the 1980s. And so in a certain way, I would advise a young composer to begin with do-it-yourself and find the experts to handle this and handle that and handle that. And a lot of the young people are going that way. It's just a change in the industry.
Michael, you've written for a variety of different genres of music, from opera to orchestral music. And one reason that you've explored so many genres is because you were challenged by one of your teachers who encouraged you to concentrate on your weaknesses.
How do you know these things?
I do my research.
Thank you very much.
Initially, you were hesitant to do that. Why?
Well, that was a specific case, and it's a beloved teacher of mine at Yale. I can even say his name, Martin Bresnik, because he's still there. I visited the Yale campus last fall and gave a presentation to the students, and he was marking his 40th year, and he still looks like he's 35 years old, as far as I'm concerned. Very young man in spirit, and brilliant, brilliant mind. And he was a teacher of mine, and that's what he said. I was working on an orchestra piece, which became Ecstatic Orange, which is recorded and people still play it today. And he said, oh, well, you're doing this and you're doing that and you're doing that, but you haven't done this. You haven't written for the voice, which at the time was true. And I remember feeling all arrogant and like, well, if someone wants to build a career in music, wouldn't you reinforce the strengths? Pedagogically, it makes sense to find your weaknesses and kind of fill in the holes. But that isn't the way art works. You don't want to be well-rounded. You want to have a voice. That's what I was trying to find, is to develop a voice so that people, when they would hear the music, say, if you're driving on the radio and the piece comes on, people might say, oh, that kind of sounds like Michael Torkey's music. That was the goal. So to me, you would achieve that goal, if it were possible, by reinforcing the strengths rather than going after the weaknesses.
Your new recording, Sky, finds you stretching yourself even further. It features the Albany Symphony and violinist Tessa Lark, and they gave the world premiere of this bluegrass-inspired concerto. First of all, tell me who Tessa Lark is.
I had never heard of her. Just one of those things, an email arrives or it was a phone call. Out of the blue, an inquiry came from this young violinist, Tessa Lark. And she had been given the opportunity to play a debut concert at Carnegie Recital Hall and was given money to commission. And her boyfriend, Michael Thurber, had gone to the Interlaken Music Academy, and they had performed my music. And he said, check out this guy's music. So she did, and she called me up and said, you want to work together? I said, sure. I wrote a piece for violin and piano called Spoon Bread. She played it beautifully at her concert. It went over very well. I was pleased with it. And in the program note, I wrote how, with the detaché bowing, meaning one bow stroke per note, it brought about a kind of a hearkening back to Baroque music, but also to a bluegrass tradition. And after all, Tess is from Kentucky, and so here I was making these claims of a bluegrass influence. We went into the recording studio not long after, and we were just on a break. I was saying, Tessa, how would you feel if I was really inspired by bluegrass? And that's something you say in a program note. And she said, well, would you consider doing that? And then the engineer, Silas Brown, who is the engineer of this recording, said, now, that's an idea. If you do that, Michael, and Tessa, you play it, I'll record it. Even before we had even found an orchestra or found a budget. And I thought, oh, well, that's a good sign. If a recording guy wants this to happen, maybe Tessa and I should think about it. So I said, well, Tessa, would you work with me? Would you teach me about the form as I do my investigations? Can I bring ideas to you? You take out your violin and play. Tell me what works. And she said, yes. She's very collaborative. And that's the genesis of this. So it was no commission. The money to support it came later as we, through her agent and my publisher, again, it's Bill Hall of Music, not Boosey & Hawkes. He does things like puts contracts together for me. We found 10 orchestras to support the project and to invite Tessa to perform. And the lead orchestra was the Albany Symphony, who did that recording the day after the premiere.
The piece is titled Sky, and in order to create it, you had to learn how to speak the language of bluegrass. How did you do that?
Working with Tessa, but also what I did is I went online, I went on YouTube, and I just was watching like young fiddle players, and this teenage girl, forgotten her name now, she's a big artist in Kentucky, wins all the fiddle competitions. She said, oh, well, there's this app you can get. It's called the Amazing Slowdowner. Never heard of it. Because it's an oral tradition. Fiddle players listen, and then they play. So I thought, I got to get this app. What it does is it slows down music, but it doesn't make the pitch lower. And so you can slow it down by 5 times, and then you can transcribe these great fiddle licks that all the expert fiddlers play. And that's how I started transcribing music and learning the nuts and bolts of how bluegrass worked. So, for example, I started with banjo picking because, to me, it's so intricate. And the theme to the Beverly Hillbillies was performed by one of the major bluegrass people, one of the biggest names in the business. And I always thought growing up and seeing that show on television that that was the most amazing music I ever heard. How does that work? It goes by so fast. So I slowed it down, I transcribed it, and I thought, well, wouldn't it be interesting if you took banjo picking and you gave it to a violin to play? Because we think of bluegrass fiddle music as having a fiddle tradition. So already I was trying to break away with what they did by giving Tessa banjo music to play. That's what you hear in the first movement.
So how did you do that? How did you apply banjo picking styling to the violin?
So a banjo has open strings and a violin has open strings, and you start there and how they're tuned differently. And so I tried to write figures that would jump around but would use the open strings so that it would sound really virtuosic but would be quite accessible for the violin. Because with a banjo picking, your fingers just hit the strings. With a violin, you have to cross, your bow has to cross strings. You have to be really careful to plan it all out. And that's what Tessa and I worked out together.
So how did Celtic tunes become the basis for the second movement?
In my research, I heard that Irish settlers moved to Kentucky. Now, I was told that it was Scottish settlers who started all of the Kentucky whiskey and the bourbon and all of that. And so I might be wrong about that. But what Tessa confirmed was that Irish fiddle players do some of the same techniques and have the same expression as bluegrass fiddlers. So I started studying Irish music. And then I thought, well, there you have jigs and you have reels. It's a different kind of thing, but some of the music sounds similar, just different. And I thought, well, what if I took a reel and slowed it down? A composer reel and then slow it down, and that could become the second movement. And that's what we hear in the second movement of Sky.
And then in the final movement, you've got some bluegrass fiddling in triplet time.
Yes, which is quite common. And this was, you hear some of the slides of the strings. This is the most idiomatic fiddle bluegrass playing. And I mean, it takes all the way to the third movement to get there.
Why did you call the work Sky?
A specific reason and a kind of a no reason at all. I like single syllable titles. I like it to be short and concise. And I like it somehow to be kind of unexpected, and it sort of doesn't make any sense, but then it sort of does. Can't explain it. But then I thought, and I do say this in a program note, that when you look up and you see the expanse of the sky, there's an openness about that. I felt in writing this piece there was an openness or a kind of a renewed freshness I had working with music materials, because I was working in a new form, and it took out all the cobwebs in the brain, all the old habits. It kind of opened me up. And I thank Tessa in my program note for opening this door of the imagination.
Michael, as I was listening to this fiddle concerto, I was asking myself, now, am I hearing Michael Torkey in this work that has this new feel to it, this new sound for him? And I believe I was, especially in the orchestration. Can you describe what might be a signature sound for you?
Well, it has something to do with the orchestration, and I'm not quite sure what that is, except it's a style that was taught a lot at Eastman and Yale through Joseph Schwantner on the one hand, who has a kind of transparency to his orchestration, and Jacob Druckmann on the other, which brings about a kind of neo-impressionism. And a whole generation of composers in my age group have been influenced by those two things. You can hear that in Chris Theofanides' music and Kevin Putz's music, to give two examples. For me, the two big orchestrational influences are Ravel on the one hand and Tchaikovsky on the other. Everything that they write just works. It has this sound. It has this, what I call, a ping to it. There's no lugubrious kind of mixed intentions, dirt, goop, or whatever. It's bright and it's fresh, and that comes through with the orchestration. A real measure of orchestration in my book is, can a not-so-good orchestra, like a high school orchestra, sound good when they're playing classical music? Well, if a simple Tchaikovsky piece is put in front of them, it sounds amazing because the orchestration is so good. It means that the instruments are working together, so they reinforce their strengths. They're not working against each other. So that's one of my goals.
I think one of your goals also, whether you realize it or not, or maybe it is quite intentional, is the fact that your music is very accessible. It's enjoyable to listen to. It still challenges the listener, but still makes it a really pleasant experience. And often the music, even if there is a darkness to it, there is still some joy in there. Can you talk a little bit about that in terms of the way that you write?
Yeah, I mean, think about it. Some of the composers that we've loved down through the centuries, Bach stands out, Mozart. We can speak about Beethoven. These are extremely challenging composers, you know, that reach the heights of civilization so that we can study Beethoven our entire lives. Bach is maybe even a better example, whose mysteries you work your whole life and you still can't figure it out. And in the case of those three composers, put on a track. It's pleasant. So since when is this idea of enjoyable or pleasant antithetical to intellectual challenges? And that's something I've thought about since being a student, a college student, and all the way through my life. I don't know why profundity has to be inscrutable. It can be mysterious, but when I use the word inscrutable, I mean in certain modernist traditions, you hear a piece and it's painful to listen to and you can't make sense of it. And the artist says, oh, well, it's because you don't know enough. You're not qualified, you know, or Milton Babbitt used to say, he was misquoted, but who cares if you listen? We don't even need an audience. Well, come on. Of course we care. An audience is the most important thing. And besides that, a collective audience is far smarter than any one given artist in my book. So don't ever put down an audience. So this idea that there can be something that you can find immediately pleasant or beautiful or pretty or whatever, and something that you can return to, listen after listen, and still find something more, that appeals to me.
There are three more concertos on this recording, each with one word titles, your favorite, West, South, and East. And each one features a different wind instrument as a soloist. Would you talk a little bit about each of these works and what makes them unique?
Well, one thing was the nature of that commission. David Ellen Miller said, Michael, I want you to write concertos, and they can't be any longer than 10 minutes. That was the cap. And I think the agreement was I would write three movement concertos. That means that any movement could only be about 3 to 3.5 minutes. So brevity was something imposed upon me. But look at the examples we have before us. Vivaldi has very short movements, and they're very satisfying pieces. And I thought it would be a really interesting challenge to write short movements. So that was the start. The next idea was, being a bassoonist in high school, I played back in Milwaukee. It was called Music for Youth, and I was the principal bassoon. I have a feel of the woodwind section in the orchestra, how it feels to play the bassoon, and how it feels to blow into an instrument and make a sound. So I was drawn to these three instruments, the bassoon, the oboe, and the clarinet, for that reason, too. And especially if you listen to the bassoon concerto, it pushes the limits to what a bassoon can do. And I was well aware that I put the player right on the edge of the possible.
I'm curious what you may have learned about yourself as you were creating this project.
One of the things that I learned, especially with Sky, the concerto for violin, was that I may in the end do my best work when someone doesn't tell me what to do. Even though I love those challenges, I just talked about how David Miller, the conductor, said, write a short, three short woodwind concertos. I loved it, loved the challenge. But ultimately, I guess I'm getting to a certain age where I kind of have dreams of things that I want to do, and I don't want to wait around for a commission, and I don't want a commissioner to say, and we need it for such and such a date, and it has to be for this person. I met Tessa. I think she is brilliant as a human being and as an artist. I wanted to do something special with her. I talked it over, and then we sat down and we did it. I said, don't worry about contracts. Don't worry about money. Don't worry about anything. We didn't even have an orchestra at that point. But we both believed that it could become something. And I think that that leads me to do my best work. That's what I learned. And in the project that I'm working on right now and the project after that, they're also self-imposed projects where I dream up something really wacky. And I just say to myself, don't worry about the money. The money will follow or it won't. And I will realize these projects. And I hope that it's opened me up.
That's New Classical Tracks from American Public Media with Michael Torkey talking about his latest recording, Sky, and many other things that have inspired him and impacted his life. If you're enjoying New Classical Tracks, the absolute best thing you can do for the show is to tell somebody about it, help spread the word, and also take a moment to rate and review us on your podcasting app. Special thanks to Valerie Kaler for producing this episode. I'm Julie Amacher.